This is a reading from Richard Rose's Albigen Papers, the seventh paper, titled Discernment. Some of the preceding papers have been critical of the lack of orderliness in the outstanding sects and movements. Now, this does not mean that I wish to be destructively iconoclastic alone or that I intend to build a better icon. If I have a system, it is simply a system by which truth is reached by the continual analyses, not breakage, of various transcendental poses and by the constant vigil over the many factors within the self. I make this statement because it worked for me and in my lifetime. The system is not new, nor mine alone. I can only hope to clarify things a bit. If the truth is within us and we do not see it, it can only be that we see through the glass darkly at this stage of the game. This book has been in the writing process for about 10 years. This time, while it should have given me ample time and opportunity to rewrite and rewrite again, was also spent in studying ways in which to express that which few people ever try to express once they have reached the experience. Consequently, I chose to ignore grammatical symmetry and work more in fear of not saying enough to describe an abstract goal. We come at this point to the business of the paradox, which may have been explained before. However, to point at myself for a moment, you will find that I attack many movements for their lack of common sense. It must follow then that there must be a way, using a little more common sense, to outline a sort of summary of what this book is about. Of course, the ultimate paradox lies in the knowledge by me or in the intuition of mine that there is not any common sense method of describing that which I presume to be the discovery which might be labeled cosmic consciousness. However, until such time as when we are wired to the wheel no longer, we must make out the best we can with words and pray for the proper intuition to speak the best ones and pray that the reader has an intuition of rapport. I would like to list the five following premises as a summary to the previous papers. Number one, that the majority of the isms that serve as religions and philosophical guidelines for humanity are permeated by inconsistencies, and that in these isms many of the so-called facts are illusions or half-truths, and that most of man's beliefs are the product of fear and wishful thinking rather than an unbiased search for truth. Number two, that the human mind is not infallible in its processes and that it suffers errors as a result of many factors, such as the conflicting clamor of appetites, intellectual limitations, fatigue, inadequate intuition, inadequate reasoning, or inadequate common sense faculties, difficulties of the dual mind in the solving of abstract or absolute considerations, and the lack of individual control over states of mind. Number three, that there is a system of overcoming these errors, and the system is practical and truth may be realized. Number four, that the rate of realization is directly proportional to the amount of and quality of energy and attention applied to the quest. Number five, that illusions are the great obstacle to truth, and that the dispelling of these illusions involves the improvement of the inadequate factors mentioned in premise two, and better control over them. This process involves an ever-conscious schooling of the mind so that it will be an instrument of truth. In reference to the message of premise 3 and 4, I have come to the following conclusions. A. That there is a path to truth, from ignorance to relative knowledge, from relative knowledge to an awareness of the limitation of such knowledge. And finally, we pass from that which we recognize as a loosely associated intelligence to a reality of being. B. That this path is not visible by even many who profess to be on a path, It is true that there are many paths, and it is also true that most people on those paths are quite convinced that theirs is the only real path. It is not until after they become broad enough to see that their path is at most only equal to many other paths that they take another step and look about for a path that will lead them still further. C. At the graduation from the field of many paths to a more selective path among the decreasing choices of paths, as the searcher retreats from incomplete or lesser paths, is a phase of entering the final path. D. That the path does not require years of lesson taking and is not bought with money. By the same token, we should not expect it to be brought to us on a gold server. Money spent should so be used as to hold a particular group together. E. That if we apply the same amount of energy that is wasted in any of the material pursuits, we would see spiritual results. And as in any material venture, the results of transcendental efforts are also proportional to the efficient interrelation of workers and brothers, whether it be in a study group or in some act resulting from mutual convictions. We go back to premise 2 and add the following notes. A lot can be said about techniques that are relative to our thinking processes or that help in understanding ourselves. This is a partial list. Number 1. Progressive elimination of concepts and concept building by eliminating those not as consistent within themselves, not as inclusive, and those whose scope does not bridge the range of unexplained phenomena as well as some other system of thinking does. Number 2, self-observation. Number 3, self-remembering. That's looking at our past. Number 4, the respectful doubt. Number 5, application of the paradox. Number 6, development of the intuition. Number 7, retaining the identity of the real observer in various states of mind. I do not wish to give the impression that I am about to embark upon a course that will employ premises with pursuant conclusions and thus produce facts from a jumble of words. I only wish to list some observations in an orderly manner. If the reader is looking for a syllogistic proof, he can quit reading now. If psychology is in its infancy, transcendentalism, its parent, also has its share of confusion, and the application of logic to transcendentalism will, in most cases, increase that confusion. A lifetime accumulates for us experiences and the hope that a new slant and the description of such will, if nothing else, bring a new type of inquiring mind into the search. The slant is not all new either. Many of the suggestions found here will be found elsewhere, but not always in this combination. We come now to laws. Down through the ages, mystics and scientists regarded the finding of laws to be the equivalent of finding milestones of progress. The discovery of natural laws has had a profound effect upon theological convictions, and the observation of laws of nature has caused some theologians to claim them as proof that a central or singular intelligence was running the universe. The notice of the same laws has caused materialists to proclaim that the universe is running itself. For an example, we refer to the law of equilibrium. Everything seems to be in balance. At the same time, everything is changing. The planets are not bumping into one another, but the whole universe is either decaying or growing. So that the law of equilibrium is conditional to the law of change. And all of this operates in a pre-established particular degrees. These degrees are gauged by the environment of each entity over which that entity has no control. We might liken it to the cohesiveness of the water in the ocean. There is a built-in equilibrium system in the sea levels. Water is supposed to flow toward its lowest point, yet we know that the water is humped in the middle of the ocean to conform to the shape of the earth. The ocean is not flat across, in other words. Supposedly, the centrifugal forces with gravity and the continents are neither flooded nor is the water flung out into space. Yet there is something that is not built into this Earth system, such as an allowance for catalytical results of other celestial bodies when those bodies come too close. Thus, when the moon and the Earth are in a certain relationship, we have the tides. That cohesiveness quality diminishes, and a part of the shore is flooded. The same discrepancy occurs within the human body. There is an equilibrium among the cells of the body, but each cell is dying and being replaced. There is an equilibrium between the bodies or persons of humans, but these same bodies are being replaced. We notice the stars are floating in what seems to be an eternal pattern, but we have learned that they too are either changing or dying. Each in its own environment is subject to laws controlling its environment, but such laws do not affect the environment, which is a degree or more above. Recent observations in ecology have demonstrated that man can upset the equilibrium of the balanced aquaria of lower forms of life. Perhaps thousands of years of organic growth and soil balance may be destroyed when the farmer plows in the cold winter, freezing out the grubs and perhaps the whole ferment of life that differentiates soil from clay. At any rate, the grub is certainly deprived of his equilibrium in his dimension. Man can seine the seas empty of fish and possibly create in a test tube the proteins that have been lost by the forfeiture of our natural food source. And by the same token, we are expendable. But man is somewhat inhibited from depleting the human population either by the killing of an individual or the slaughter of an army. So that equilibrium is a changing thing and is subject to the eternal paradoxes brought about by the incomplete human knowledge of our final resting place and the final resting place of all things, including the planets and the suns. Equilibrium is a changing thing because the equilibrium that existed among animals and plant life in the days of the dinosaurs is not the same as that which exists today. And so it is with things spiritual. There is a law of equilibrium here, too. It is called karma, the law of retribution, or divine law. It is viewed as being punitive, while in fact it is only regulatory. The law of equilibrium, or karma, has in effect that a being may kill its inferiors, but not its equals or its superiors. It may offend its inferiors, but not its peers or its superiors. So that we suffer no great consequence if we kill off spirochetes or mice, but we rarely get away with killing another human. I am aware that most Indians define karma as being a chain of responsibility that ties men to animals in their temporal destiny, and this Indian definition leads me to use the word equilibrium. Many Christians prefer to use the word karma because of their abhorrence of the word sin, or any word that might imply personal guilt. But they still do not agree with the Indians that man is held responsible for every ant on his path. It is good to know that if we follow this karmic line of thinking, that of non-responsibility for lesser beings, there is no reason for us to presume that creatures superior to ourselves are restricted to our laws or our concepts of generosity. Different moral and ethical standards may be found in different environments and dimensions. This has been perceived by some transcendentalists who have taken advantage of the knowledge by first claiming themselves to be superior and secondly claiming themselves to be above the karmic laws of this environment. We can see, however, that if entities of a superior degree are not held to our laws, it is rather vain to presume that they operate in our code of justice. We may be either the goodies in their garden or the grubs. Man cannot help looking desperately for changelessness, immortality. It is evident to us that all of nature is a dying process from the virus to the constellations. The urge to live is as meaningless as the fear of death. We do not really know the reasons for either life or death. It is a fair guess, however, that we are able to point upward and note that there is a higher degree using the concept of progression. We feel like microbes dying on the face of the earth in order to promote something for the well-being of this planet, but we must not hurry to deify the planet. It too is dying, waxing, or waning. A few of the laws. The law of equilibrium. The law of change. This negates anything as being constant outside of the absolute state. The law of proportional returns. The law of extra proportional returns. The law of relativity. The law of paradoxical immanence in all things relative. The law of complexity. The law of love. The law of faith. The law of the ladder. The law of the vector. These are by no means inexorable laws, which once broken will damn us to the world of the crustacean. It is not a complete list, nor would a study of their interrelation give us the final key to the ultimate cause or the final end. The application of them or the observance of them will help us understand things not previously understood. They may also save us a few sore spots which are normally incurred by banging our heads against walls that do not move. In the process of setting up a system of work for achieving truth or appreciating truth, these laws have a very important place. There are laws which we find expressed in occult works, and I think that they are all worthy of notice if they were not invented to impress the reader. Gurdjieff speaks of the law of three and the law of seven. There is a certain periodicity and reoccurrence that pervades the physical world, but I consider it tangential at this time to study all of the material laws. Let us run through some of the laws and apply them to the work. The law of proportional returns is another way of saying that you will get that which you give. This is the reversal of retribution. We offer instead of taking, and we find that it works. The law also infers that we can cause a ripple, that we can accomplish something and still not upset the equilibrium of our dimension. We may say that effort is rewarded as long as it works within the laws of our dimension. We take another step and say that helping others inspires help. Helping also develops in us a more acceptable attitude, but these social advantages do not measure a law. The mechanism of a law infers an automatic result. Historically, the Christians were the first to utilize the business of giving and to make it a functional part of their philosophy. They gave of themselves to the point of self-immolation. They practically worked the law to death along with themselves. Another law should be observed concurrently with the law of proportional returns. It is the law of the ladder. The ladder here is used as a symbol to show that there should be a selective giving of goods, energy, or spiritual help. The law of the ladder simply says that you should not reach below the rung upon which you stand except to the first rung below you in order to help people. If you reach down too low, your efforts will be wasted and you may be hurt or crucified. The law of the ladder also says you cannot be helped by anyone too far above you because you are not prepared to work with that person on the same level at which he is working. The law of love is another law which brought trouble to the early Christians. It was discovered that hate only generates hate. Killing invites killing. Love, on the other hand, invites love. I doubt if there is any advantage for a person who loves someone who would like to kill him. Such a union might bring about a homicidal child that might really kill and love the killing. In fact, Christianity bore such a child. It was the monstrous acts of the Inquisition. It has been said that the Sikhs, that for generations they were a peaceful people. I do not have the exact figures as to the years involved, but a guru of an Indian sect who was formerly a Sikh, he may be a Sikh still, told me that there had been quite a long line of peaceful gurus. The Mohammedan invasions repeatedly afflicted the state of Kashmir, which is the Sikh home ground. Holy men were tortured and slain. Finally, one day, one of the gurus rode up and told his people that passivity was a mistake. He advised them to defend themselves, and as a result of his advice, we have a very formidable group of people who find the sword to be the partner of the Granth Sahib, the Sikh Bible. The proper application of the law of love should be in the direction of the friends upon the path, meaning those on our rung and the two adjacent rungs. This love can be expressed as friendship of the most unselfish type. For those too many rungs above us, we can only offer respectful silence. For those who cannot see us too well, being less fortunate, we can only afford compassion. Anything other than compassion may verge on self-deifying egotism. The law of extra proportional returns can be effected only with the cooperation of friends. The law of proportional returns tells us that we can count the number of yards that a gallon of gas will take a truck. It adds that if we put 2 gallons in, we can expect only to go twice as far. The law of extra proportional returns infers an unexpected increment. To draw the analogy, two factors, human, will accomplish more results together than will either of the two factors in twice as much time. This is also known as the contractor's law. If this law did not exist, no contractor would hire men. It would all be done by individuals working alone. It was only when Henry Ford progressed to the assembly line production that he really started making money. The principle works in somewhat the following manner. One man can build a certain type of house in 90 days. Two men working together will be able to build it in 42 or 43 days. And 5 men, each specializing in a particular trade, may build it in 15 days or 75 man days. And with more men, the work will be closer to perfection. We apply the same principle to spiritual work. Since we are working with inadequate tools in the hope of doing something more difficult than building a rocket for the moon, it is a good idea to give some of these laws a practical appraisal, especially in view of the fact that men, whom we have recognized as being spiritual authorities, have found that employment of the law of extra proportional returns to be expedient in the same way that it is recommended here. We must work in groups, in other words. You can tell them, call them brotherhoods or societies, or you can work in groups without a name. Gurdjieff called it a school. It is very difficult for a man to work alone. He tends to drift. If he does not drift, he may slip off on a tangent and become hallucinated, self-hypnotized, or plainly obsessed. He needs a mirror to watch for his own possible deviations, and he finds such a mirror in the minds of his colleagues, if nothing else. And when he realizes the value of cooperation, the only sensible thing to do is form a pattern of cooperation, which pattern should allow for new brothers on the path. Now, the law of the ladder has more meaning. We do not visualize a single man upon each rung reaching down, pulling up the man below. We find that the ladder is A-shaped, pyramid in form, for one thing. There are less people on the higher rungs than on the lower rungs. We will be lucky if we can find one man who can help us, but we should be working with 6 or more on the rung below. We also find a new meaning for the brotherhood now. The man above may be pulling up the man below, but they are pushing him a bit at the same time. It is good to read books of sundry types and even join a cult or two to hear that which they have to say, but there is no substitute for the ashram or school. 40 years of solitary reading will not do for the individual that which would be accomplished by a 2-year stay at a genuine ashram. If this were not true, monasteries would not have endured down through the centuries, and monasteries are not always ideal ashrams. We come now to the law of the reverse vector. This is first recognized by the student who has become mature enough to define himself as a student and not a god or perfect being with perfect understanding. In spiritual matters, man must become identified as a vector or force if he wishes for results. If this vector is aimed in the wrong direction, his life is wasted. Most people do not even bother to make of themselves a vector, even in uncertain spiritual drives. They announce their objectives before they begin to study and then later announce that they have reached it. The law of the reverse vector states that you cannot approach the truth. You must become a vector, but you cannot learn the absolute truth. Not knowing the truth in the beginning, nor even the true path, we still wish to move toward the truth. We find that there is only one way, and that is to first build of ourselves a very determined person, a vector. We cut off tangential dissipators of energy and ball up this energy for the work ahead. And then, like most of the clergy, we make the mistake of putting years of this precious energy first into one blind direction and then another until we learn that we must reverse the vector. We must back into the truth by backing away from untruth. We still may gamble a bit because we will not know those things which are untrue in every case. We must develop a faculty, consequently, for being more aware of the difference between things true and things untrue. And it will not come suddenly, but we must begin with a simple start and with faith in progression. All of us can discern between things ridiculously unlikely and things possible. Later, we will take the category of things possible and search it for those things which are more possible, brushing aside the category of things unlikely. And still later, we'll begin to realize our reasons for making erroneous choices in the early stages of discernment. Research or study along transcendental lines cannot parallel material or objective scientific research. The laws of physics, as we can see, hold some good or hold inspiration for psychic research. When we reach the point that we feel we must become rather than learn, then many things operating as physical laws must be looked at in a new light. We are still relative creatures in a relative world trying to find that which may be an absolute value. And those who find it call it the absolute. But this word has about as much meaning as the mathematical term infinity, 1/0. In a way, it is useless to use the term until we know that which we are discussing. And when we know that which the absolute is, we may feel that it is useless to discuss it or use the term. Being relative creatures, we must use words. They are still the language that makes the latter possible. Words are the cursed cause of nearly all confusion and lack of understanding, but also the means of considerable rapport on abstract ideas not communicable with telepathy. When we reach the stage at which we decide to become, we have to launch this reverse vector, and only after it has cleared the last heavy interference from any obstacles listed in the fifth paper. And as we launch it, we find ourselves receding away from the relative world and its laws to a point where we find things in a paradoxical state of flux rather than answering to the laws of physics. Here is not here, and it is not there. Time does not exist apart from space, yet time is eternal. We come now to the law of paradoxical immanence, for all things relative. Very early in this search, we got a hint of this. We find at first observations that the visible world is in a relative state. We identify an interdependence among all things and their definitions. Everything is, for instance, relative to the ability for measuring by the eye of the beholder. We notice a mental dependency upon relationship or association. We cannot think without association, and this form of identification with ourselves is expressed in the words law of relativity, which has nothing to do with Einstein. Paradoxically, we are related to all things, even to our hallucinations, illusions, and intangible emotions. We are related, but we cannot ever clearly think until we come to a process of dissociation from the endless tangle of identification. Buddha hinted of this process when he advised as a third step that we think of nothing. There is another instance of relativity. We find that the cycles of the electrons are similar to the circling orbits of the planets around their stars. We find that the single reproductive cell may be a microcosm of the relatively huge human being or elephant. we find that the size, mass, may be affected by speed. Then we go a step further and notice that things may often be or appear to be the opposite of that which they were originally. We discover what appears to be an imminent paradox in all of our findings and postulates. This tends to confuse and deter most minds from coming to a positive stand on many matters. And this may be a good thing. Too often the critical mind poses as being infallible in its concept building. The paradox, while disquieting, is often, for the thinker, the first real hint that there is a transience about the observable physical world that will always elude his inquiries. There are several paradoxes in physics which have to do with the curvature of space and the nature of time. The paradox only exists in the relative phases of analysis or in the observation of laws with this relative viewpoint, and this includes spiritual laws. The student must keep the application of these laws within the dimensions in which they were intended and in which they are operative. For instance, we may observe the law of love and conclude that love has a power over hate. Then perhaps the student, a bit bravely or stupidly, launches out to conquer some space with love and finds that he comes under increasing attack. And in another compartment of space, he observes that another human being is conquering quite a bit of space or people with hate, so that for a while he thinks that the opposite of the law of love may also hold true, or he thinks that the law of love is spurious or is mere Pollyanna. In the first place, if the student abided by the law of love, he would not have played politics with it nor tried to change people. And secondly, he would have known that the law of love has definite limitations in the natural world. It cannot clash with other laws, and least of all with the law of the jungle. All of the love in the world will not avert the carnivorous functioning of nature. The law of inertia is likewise paradoxical. The definition of the law of inertia reads that things tend to remain inert, or in status quo. Things actually tend to change, to drift into activity, and to burst forth into life as well. Some theorize that the universe is dying, others theorize that the universe is ever expanding, and still other theorize with equal reasoning that the entire universe sprang forth from a black hole of inactivity. We witness the death of a planet or a man, or we note the disintegration of an atom and say that everything tends to die. However, we witness throughout nature the process of dying is simultaneous with the process of birth. And there is an innate essence that goads all forms of life against the inert tendency. Of course, there may be some argument as to whether this force is innate or external to the organism. Sometimes it is apparently internal as the procreative urge, and while it seems to work from within us, it has no long-range benefits for us as an individual organism. And thus we may be slow to own an urge that seems to be using us for the benefit of others or others' purposes. This force manifests itself upon us in the form of curiosity and desire. We do not plan to have desire or curiosity. Consequently, while seeming to be motivated from within, we are moved by implants. Some parents, such as certain spiders and caterpillars, are eaten by their mates or by their young. Actually, all parents are, to a degree, eaten by their young. But when we witness the mating instincts of this spider, we must assume that such instincts are powerful indeed to prompt it to copulate when it must almost immediately die when the act is performed. The same situation applies to the salmon, which literally tear their bodies to pieces to find a remote sanctuary for their eggs. Unless these urges are exerted upon the salmon, spider, caterpillar, and the man from outside, meaning a possible directive force in his environment not necessarily visible and not yet properly subjected to scrutiny, they would try to prolong their lives rather than submit to momentary pleasure. It is reasonable to presume that all forms of life and even matter are similarly inspired or forced. The law of faith is another law that has its limitations. Faith will not move mountains, possibly because of other laws. Too many people believe that the mountains will remain at rest and not be moved by faith. This is counter faith. The law of faith does have to do with the changing of the apparent status of matter by means of human belief. It has been recognized by some occultists as being the actual method of the creation of the physical universe. We might say that the limitations spoken of above concerning the capacity of faith to affect material objects are dependent upon the mind quantum factor. This presumes that there is a quantum called faith, which, though evidently immeasurable except by result, would signify certain units of faith power per mind unit per person. The size of the miracle would depend upon the intensity of the belief of those minds. Healers are found to be most effective in multitudes and less effective among people from their hometown. Since the law of faith is generally applied for ostentation and applied to physical bodies, much of its value is overlooked. Some quiet theologians indicate that our very postmortem existence hinges upon the creation through faith of lands to come by combined faith acts of all men or a majority of them. The law of complexity may well be called the law of life, since life is found only in very complex structures. Some thinkers take another brash step and announce that life is in fact nothing but complexity. Cybernetics indicates that complexity may be related to responses which might be identified with life. The law of complexity in application to the work has a particular meaning. While the complexity of molecular structures forms a life matrix, it cannot be denied that such structures are highly unstable, so that protoplasm is forever dying and being replaced. We also note that any transcendental movement that has allowed itself to become complex and to sprout all sorts of ramifications is in the same jeopardy as protoplasm. It tends to die. And the avoidance of this complexity makes the work of members in a brotherhood even more difficult and complex. They must be vigilant for symptoms of any tendency toward becoming a vegetating institution and must at all times follow the path of simplification rather than elaboration and dogmatism.